Okay, next up is our look at Liverpool's financial situation vis-a-vis fair play regulations. We took as our inspiration for this feature an article from Beyond the Cop site by Nazareth Degama and Ed Thompson, which attempted a projected analysis of Liverpool with regard to the financial impact of commercial revenue, also player transfers in and out of LFC. The article then tried to provide an early projected income statement for the financial year of 2013-2014. So we're lucky tonight to be able to speak directly with Ed. Ed, thanks for joining us tonight.
Hey, that's okay. Thanks for asking me.
First off, Ed, your site, financialfairplay.co.uk, is dedicated to new financial regulations that are in place. And Liverpool FC have put themselves alongside Arsenal in the vanguard of pro-FFP lobby since the arrival of FSG. Are Liverpool becoming poster boys for FFP, or are they hindering themselves, in your opinion, by hitching their wagon so publicly to this particular setup?
No, I don't think they're hindering themselves in any way. I mean, you know, let's face it, the rules have come in, so everybody's going to have to comply with the rules. And, you know, I think that there's an element of self-interest amongst the Liverpool owners, to be honest, that, you know, nobody wants to be in a position where you're losing £30-40 million every year. And actually, the financial fair play rules will mean that now with this new TV deal, that the club should really be on a kind of
wage movement.
Actually start to kind of break even and you know, perhaps even make a profit as well. So I think there's some self-interest in it in there as well. And also, having said that, there is also a piece of self-interest in as much as these rules will help the club. You know, they will put the brakes, as we've seen, on, you know, clubs like Manchester City and Chelsea and Paris Saint-Germain and other clubs who have been spending very freely. They'll put the brakes on them, and that will kind of improve the competitive position of Liverpool.
Sure. So basically, the way you're looking at it, there's a certain element of self-interest there from FSG's point of view. From the club's point of view, Ed, do you see Liverpool benefiting ultimately from sticking rigidly to the rules and like being to the fore and pushing them, or do you see it as something that could ultimately be a negative for the club?
Oh, no, I can't see any way that would be a negative for the club, to be honest. It's hard to predict the future. I mean, that is the difficult part here. You know, if we knew what was going to happen to the club in the future, if the club could guarantee on Champions League income, where it would be getting £30 million a year, you know, if you knew what was going to happen with new sponsorship deals, if you knew what was going to happen with future TV deals, then perhaps, you know, it'd be a much clearer position. But unfortunately, you can't. So I think the financial fair play should play to Liverpool's advantage, in as much as you've got to balance your incomings and outgoings, and Liverpool have a very strong international fan base. They're able to write very large commercial deals. You know that their current kit deal is huge, so they see the benefit of that. And so, provided they can effectively get into the Champions League, which, you know, they may well do this season, then I think the future does look pretty bright for the club, to be honest.
Excellent. There was a statement in the article that really took me by surprise. I just want to run it past you before I let the other guys ask you a few questions. And the statement was pretty stark. There was a reference to the mythical net spend figure, which is largely irrelevant. Now, for most people, they think they're on the cutting edge if they're quoting net spend. They seem to think that it's very much where it's at. Could you explain the rationale behind the statement that net spend is actually a mythical idea?
Yes, no, it's a bit complicated. So don't doze off, because it's a little bit to do. I need to talk about accounts here. But all the financial fair play rules basically require broadly clubs to break even. Okay, so what is breaking even? Well, you know, you would expect it to be, well, you know what you're spending and you know what incomes you've got. I mean, it should be a fairly easy process. However, when we look at football clubs, the big expenditure is on transfer fees. And so, actually, the way that the UEFA's rules and accountancy rules work are that the money spent on a player has to be written off over a number of years. So if, you know, take the famous signing of Torres, Fernando Torres, who cost about £50 million. He was signed by Chelsea on a five-year deal. Well, actually, in terms of the accounts, that didn't get recorded as a minus £50 million in year one. Because it was on a five-year deal, it actually records as a minus £10 million for each of the next five seasons. And so, you can spend a lot of money on a player, but actually not have a huge impact on the bank accounts that year. And then the reason why it also gets a bit messy is you know, what happens when you come to sell a player? Well, actually, if you sell, once you sell a player, actually, whether you've made a profit or a loss in the accounts is all dependent on what we call the book value, and it kind of gets a bit nitty-gritty and potentially boring to some people, but sure. Actually, when you've got the player like Torres, who was bought for £50 million, in the books of the club, he gets written down at £10 million a year as a cost. And after two seasons, he's actually sitting in there as a book value of £30 million. And then once you sell the player, if they sold the player on, well, actually, if they sold him for more than £30 million, they'd recorded that as a profit in that year. And if they sold it for less than £30 million, it would be a loss. So you can see, actually, you can get to a position where you can sell a player for well less than you bought them for, but actually record it as a profit in that year.
Right.
It gets quite complicated. I mean Carroll perhaps is an example closer to people's hearts, you know. People
yeah.
think, well, you know, we bought him for £35 million, I believe it was, and sold him for whatever it was, £17 million. But actually, by the time Liverpool sold the player, he had a book value of about £17 million anyway. So in terms of the, you know, the impact in the accounts for that year, nothing. You know, it's actually the club is better off without him because they aren't then having to write down another chunk of money for the next year, and then they obviously don't have to pay his wages. So you see, it gets all a bit messy. So you can't quite look at you know, the finances of the club and say, well, you know, we've had this much money coming in and we spent this on new players. You kind of need to understand the whole position of the club. And another example is what happened at Manchester City, whereby, you know, they actually spent quite heavily in the summer, but up until the last, I think, one or two player spends, they were actually recording a net break even on the whole deal, just because of the fact that they'd let some players go. They were no longer having to write down their contract fee. They were saving money on wages. So it all gets a bit messy. So this, you know, you can't just look at, you know, net spend. You need to look at the whole position, and that's where it gets really messy. And that's where, well, people like Naz, who wrote the article, are really good. You know, he's able to.
Sure. So basically, us armchair experts who've been quoting that spend are completely clueless. Can I ask if you wouldn't mind? Phil's got a question for you now, Ed.
Ed, hey, it's Phil here. Listen, I was a bit fascinated reading your own site on financial fair play and also the intimations in Naz's article around the idea that the debt for equity conversion, in that a owner, where a loss is above the permitted loss for the year, can actually convert that to equity in the club and not actually have, well, can attain the break-even status that's set down in financial fair play. I suppose at a simple term for me, I'm trying to figure out, could that mean that sugar daddy owners like Abramovich or Sheikh Mansour, etc., could theoretically, year on year, break the rules around financial fair play for making a profit or coming in within the acceptable loss remit and continue to just convert to equity to cover whatever spend they wanted to do?
No, it doesn't quite work like that. Although up to an element, up to a point, you are right. So, you know, the idea of, you know, the UEFA's financial fair play rules are that clubs break even. Broadly, you manage the incomings and outgoings. Okay, so that's a kind of straightforward concept. But the way that they've looked at the rules is say, well, actually, you know, to be fair, you need to break even over. We won't look at break even over one season in UEFA. We'll do it over two or three seasons because that's kind of makes sense. Something might have happened one season and not the other. Okay, so that's kind of how they approach it. And then they say, actually, although we say you've got to break even, well, it's not quite break even. We'll allow you to lose over those. The initial period was two seasons. Over the first two seasons, you can lose €5 million. We'll let you lose €5 million, and with that, there's no sanction if you lose up to 5 million, because it's not that much. However, we'll actually, having said that, we'll allow you to go up to €45 million loss over those two seasons. So as long as you've got a sugar daddy owner who can inject equity into the club to cover anything over the £5 million up to the €5 million up to the €45 million.
Mm-hmm.
So that's getting a bit complicated, but basically what it's saying, over the first 2 years, you can lose €45 million, which is about £37 million.
Yeah.
But only, you can only go over this €5 million limit and go up to the €45 million maximum if the owner is prepared to inject equity. And what that means, inject equity, means that, in effect, the club creates new shares, and the owner then buys the shares. And he has to buy the shares for the amount of the equity. In this example, it would be whatever's over 5 million euros up to, however makes it, up to 45 million. So, you know, he could be putting in, you know, 40 million euros or whatever it could be. And then that money then goes into the club. That money goes into the club and the club's debts don't increase. And that's the idea behind this, that UEFA don't want the club's debts to increase. And what's the owner got to show for it? Well, he's got some more shares, more bits of paper. Well, he would have had 100% of the shares in the club anyway, so having more shares actually doesn't help him in any way. The only way he'll ever get the money back on that is if the club he sells the club for a profit, or if the club actually report a profit from you know, trading, and then actually he can pay himself a dividend out of the money. But it's kind of, he ties his money in. What the rule says you're not allowed to do is, whereas we saw in the past, clubs would just run up big debts and would owe the bank more money and, you know, living on overdrafts in effect. They're no longer able to do that. If they go over the 5 million euros, they can only go up to 45 million euros loss over those two seasons, and only then if the owner actually sticks his hand in the pockets and puts that money into the club.
Just to cut in there, right? And it's the bit that I'm trying to get my head around. Is it only for those two seasons? What I'm wondering is, at the end of the two seasons, can he continue to put it? Is there that 45 million sort of spread that they have, or does it finish there and you've only got a 5 million loss which you can run regardless of whether you're going to convert further losses to equity as such?
Well, it's a rolling process. So, you know, after that, then it looks at the next three seasons. But then the threshold is then reduced that the owner can put in.
Right.
So after the first two seasons, when it's 45 million euros over the first two seasons, then it looks at three seasons and it's like 45 million over those three seasons, and then it cuts down to 30 million over three seasons, if that's right. Yes. So it's reducing all the time, and now, I mean, the point is where we are now in this season, say for Liverpool, for example, is for this season, next season, and the season after, Liverpool's average loss has to be below £8 million a season.
Okay.
That's all it can be. And that isn't very much when you consider that they've historically lost, you know, over, you know, 30 million plus, 40 million, you know, much significantly higher figures. But now the result, you know, the maximum loss, and that's including the money that the owner can put in equity, is only around £8 million a season for, you know, this season, next season, and the season after. So the things have changed, and the big losses that we have seen are going to be reduced, and the ability for the owner to stick their hand in the pocket and credit to equity kind of starts tapering out now, and they're not really able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cheers, Ed. That's interesting stuff. Steve, here's a question for you, if that's okay.
Hi, Ed. Just something based upon what you've said there. So I was just listening back, and it's great to hear somebody give a good in-depth analysis of the FFP situation. But will this eventually stop the likes of, let's take Real Madrid, for example, who in the past have, as you said there a moment ago, run up massive debts and been bailed out left, right and centre, whatever reasons may have been given for it.
Yeah.
Will that eventually stop this form of profiteering, so to speak, from a club like that?
It's difficult. The dynamics that could say Real Madrid are a bit weird, in as much as they've got advantages. So if Real Madrid particularly, they've got advantages because the TV deal in Spain is negotiated on an individual level rather than a group level. So they get a huge, all the TV money basically, not all of it, but huge amounts gets cut up between Barcelona and Real. So they get that. They've also got big tax advantages as well. So they get huge advantages anyway. Being global brands, they're then able to write huge commercial deals. So the commercial deals that we see at the very, very top clubs are, you know, if anything, increasing. So things are potentially about to change in Spain. So, you know, we're seeing that, you know, they might not no longer be able to write individual commercial deals. They might have to pull the deals. Then the tax advantages might change. So it's a bit weird what's happening in Spain. I guess what we are seeing, I guess going back to the thrust of the question is, you know, will we see clubs that were being bankrolled by sugar daddy owners, will we see that all changing? And the answer is very much yes. It has to, you know, as long as we assume that UEFA are serious about the rules, and we haven't yet seen what kind of punishments they're going to apply for overspending, then the landscape has to change. And you could argue it already has for many clubs. There's a few who've kind of like almost buried their head in the sand and saying, actually, we're just hoping it'll go away. But and that's the interesting point to see what happens there.
Ed, how you doing? It's Stephen Brown here. Just a quick one for you, Ed. My question is, obviously, it's been driven by Platini and UEFA. What happens when Platini steps up to become the FIFA president, which looks like it will be the next step for him? Are UEFA going to keep pushing this as stringently as they will while Platini's with UEFA? And also, as a second part of that question, what will prevent, or is there any prevention measures being taken for clubs in different leagues, such as Qatar or any of the Middle Eastern clubs or Argentina or Brazil, that could go and spend the money that obviously Real Madrid and so on spend every season?
Well, I guess in terms of UEFA, the big question is how serious are they about it? I mean, Platini and his deputy have both nailed their colours to the mast on an FFP. I can't see Platini going that his, you know, his deputy, if you read all the interviews, and they're so wedded to it that the change in Platini at the top, assuming this kind of deputy takes over, which is a likely scenario, then actually there's no change. And also that the important thing about the UEFA FFP rules is that they're actually voted in by the clubs. The European Club Association voted them in. So to have somebody then at the top actually then kind of going back on it and trying to change it would be very difficult. You know, there's a lot of very strong clubs within Europe, particularly the German clubs, who are very, very strong advocates of FFP. You know, European Club Association is headed up by Rummenigge. It's part of the DNA of UEFA now. I can't see that changing. You know, it was still, the debate is how strongly it's going to punish clubs who breach the rules. But
Ed, just on that bit, is that because it benefits the bigger clubs in real terms, that FFP allows rich clubs to stay rich, and it's harder actually for the smaller clubs to become big clubs, because it's like you can't have that sugar daddy owner come in and spend 200 million, 300 million in one go to turn them into a super club?
Now, interestingly, I don't think it is, because if that had been the case, then the European Club Association, which is a huge number of clubs represent across Europe, the vast majority of whom do not have the sugar daddy only scenario, have voted for the rules to come in. And so the argument there appears to be, the reason why the clubs have voted it in is that, by and large, the vast majority of them are opposed to concepts where they are forced into a position where they have to overspend in order to succeed. And actually, genuinely, you know, you look at some of the pronouncements come out of Holland and Germany, you know, what happened at Chelsea and at Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, it's really deeply unpopular across a lot of clubs in Europe. And, you know, in each of, you know, you look at Holland, you know, it used to be in Belgium and Czech Republic. These used to be actually challenging at the top level in European football, and it hasn't been possible for it recently. And one of the things that those clubs appeared not to like was the concept of having to spend huge amounts of money in order to succeed, and not, you know, if you don't have a sugar daddy owner, or if you're restricted in being able to have one, which is the case in lots of clubs in terms of Germany, for example, then, you know, they're not able to succeed, and they would quite like, you know, the FFP rules to come in and stop that.
One very last question. I suppose one formed opinion that people have around FFP is that if you don't comply, you're out of European competition. That isn't the case. Am I right in thinking, like, and there's a good chance that if you don't comply with FFP, you're going to get a warning and then a slap on the knuckles before anything serious happens?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the way. People don't really know yet. What's happened is UEFA have issued punishments, and they've issued 9 sanctions, and they've said that any club that fails the break-even test will receive one of the sanctions. Those sanctions range from a warning up to a full exclusion from European competition. And kind of in the middle, they include things like potentially a points deduction when you're in the Champions League group stage or the Europa League group stage, or a reduction in the number of players that you can register for your European competition. So there's a kind of various levels of punishments that can apply. Although we know what the punishments are, what we don't have yet is a tariff of how those punishments will be applied. And UEFA has kind of been shying away from that, I think, because ultimately isn't. UEFA will argue that it's not actually them who's going to be issuing the punishment. They set up an independent body which will determine whether or not clubs have breached the rules, and then they'll determine what rules will be applied. And they've done that so that UEFA can be at arm's length from any of the punishments that are imposed on the club, because ultimately the clubs can then appeal to CAS. Now, what's happened under the... I mean, we talk about FFP and we talk about break-even. We're familiar with that concept. But actually, under the whole FFP rules, it also includes requirements for clubs to stay up to date with their taxes and their transfer fees paid to other clubs. It's called payables. And this concept of overdue payables is part of the FFP rules. As UEFA, through this independent board, have already sanctioned a number of clubs and banned them from European competitions for falling behind on their tax bills, basically. And so they've already applied, you know, outright bans in European competitions. So we haven't yet seen what bans they're going to, or what punishments they're going to apply for overspend. But the punishments the board have so far applied have been very severe. So, you know, it kind of, we don't really know. And we won't know until April next year what punishments will be applied to clubs. And a number of clubs will be looking at that very nervously. So the clubs are going to be Paris Saint-Germain, who have effectively failed the break-even test.
It's a tangled web, Ed, is basically what you're telling us.
Especially with Platini, somewhere. Yeah. However.
Listen, you're a gentleman. We've really enjoyed that. It's been very insightful. Thank you so much for the opinions and the answers.
And get on Ed's website.
Absolutely.
The financialfairplay.co.uk if you want more info around it.
Thanks a lot, Ed.
Brilliant. Many thanks. I enjoyed it.
Cheers. Thank you. Cheers. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Bye.
It's a preview of the...
Right, very good. Let's get started. Briefly, I want to introduce our guest, Niall Byrne. I want to thank you, Niall, for coming into us today. Niall, a former Liverpool player, youth international. We're very, very lucky to have him. And we're just going to ask some of the guys here to pop a few questions towards Niall that they've been thinking about during the week. So, Phil, I'll start with you if you have a question for Niall to get us going.
Yeah, I suppose, Niall, I remember you coming up through the ranks because you were one of the first... sort of big sort of kids going over from Ireland to Liverpool in terms of the schoolboy days, and I knew of you coming through the ranks at Lourdes as well. Just, I remember reading an article beforehand, and it was that you were a United fan prior to going away. Now, when the scouting and all was happening at the time, were United in for you, and was there more clubs than just Liverpool in for you, and what swayed the decision for Liverpool at the time?
Well, I suppose it was the first club I went to. You know, when I went to Lourdes, say around the 14 age group, things happened fairly quickly. Noel McKay was just had been appointed the head scout at the time, so he'd been the Nottingham Forest scout, and he sent away the likes of Roy Keane and stuff, so he was just had to get the Liverpool job, and I was actually the first fella he sent away, so he couldn't watch one or two matches. You know, within 6 months of going to Lourdes, I was on a plane over to England, and I think I was there for a week, the first week, and I was just like, fell in love with the place, you know. So there was clubs after that. You know, probably every club in the UK were in the size of 6 months wanting me to go over. You know, it came in for me, you know, being at the time a mad Manchester United fan, people probably couldn't understand, why don't you go to United? Just, you go to Liverpool, it's a special place, you know what I mean? Once you're there, you're settled in, you meet people, it's hard then to say, right, I'm going to go somewhere else, you know? Yeah. And that was basically it. Once I went over, once that was it, didn't want to go anywhere else.
How many trials, after the initial Liverpool trial, which, as you said, was your first one, how many other clubs did you go to?
None.
So you didn't go on a trial with United, but anyway, you just had your mind set.
I went over in, I think it was February 94, for a week. Stayed there for a week. Played a match at the end of the week against Aston Villa. Funny thing is, I went over as a centre-half, come back as a centre-forward. So, figured out now. End of the week, we played Villa. I think we beat them 2-0. I scored two of them, and they asked me to sign after the match, and that was it. Committed, didn't go anywhere else.
So when you came back then, like the clubs obviously approached your parents now, because it would have been 14 at that point, right? What was the process like in terms of, you know, how long was the negotiation before you knew you were going?
Well, back then it was...
No, I'm not looking to impact people with brown envelopes right now.
The funny thing is, like, nowadays the talk of kids going away for major money.
Yeah.
Like, I remember at the time, I was with Lourdes, they don't have the people in place back then. Like, now they have people that look after contracts for kids that go away, and, you know, people that know what they're talking about. Back then there was nobody.
Yeah.
I sat out in Dublin Airport, I remember, when I was 14, negotiating my own contract with Steve Highway, on my own. So... you know, sign your life away for buttons, basically. You know what I mean? I think at the time when they went to give Lure Celtic, whatever remuneration was in for them, it was a set of jerseys was offered at Forest, and I think they eventually got them up to a couple of thousand, but compared to what's going on now, it was, you know, it was just strange, because it would have probably gone away to all the other clubs on trial,
yeah,
and had that bargaining chip, you know. But I mean, at the time it didn't really interest me, you know what I mean? I want to go for big money or this, that and the other. It's just, you know, where's the contract, I'll sign it.
Maybe the thought behind that was, at that time, there wasn't the money in the game. the game wasn't money-driven,
yeah,
as it is now.
It was only starting.
Fowler was probably the first superstar of the Premiership era, so that he hadn't even really kicked on at that stage. Yeah. Yeah. We come back to the money side of things. Two people that I know went over, won't name the club, were the lads themselves. But I know the club they played for over here got $100,000 a piece.
Yeah.
And that was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So 10 years ago, $100,000, a hell of a lot of money. You can only imagine what it is now.
Yeah.
That there are people in specific schoolboy clubs that are just there. Their sole target is to get two or three young lads over to England every year.
Yeah.
And that's how they keep their jobs. And it's not a part-time job, it's a full-time paid position in certain clubs.
Yeah.
So it's glad that you actually got and say, even though you were only with Lourdes for 6 months, the thoughts that you actually negotiated your own contract without Lourdes even being involved in it is alien nowadays, I'd say.
So, coming back to, like, you negotiated the contract, parents obviously happy enough for you to go over.
They couldn't wait to get rid of me, yeah.
Well, you get out, the culture shock must have been huge. For a kid your age to leave Dublin, leave your family, leave the surrounds, your friends, the works, right? And pitch up in Liverpool. Now, as you said, you took to the city and the whole lot. What was it like to... It must have been...
It was mad. Like, I mean, you have to remember back then, and you try to tell kids to go away now. There's no Facebook, there's no Bebo, Twitter. Mm. You know what I mean? Keep in touch with your mates. None of that. Mm. So I think after I went over the first time, I started going over in patches, like 2 weeks here, 3 months there,
yeah,
during the summer and stuff. And then I think I moved over full time and around July 95. So it was about a year after I went over first, and it was just a case of, you know, finish the junior cert and off you went, you know. And the funny thing was, you know, we came from a big family. There were six of us. You know, your man and dad want to know where you are at all times. And I think the first house I moved into over there, the landlady was about 75. She used to go to bed at 7:30 at night, and that was it. You were sitting there looking at each other, what to be doing for the rest of the night, you know. So it was a culture shock, to say the least. But, you know, look, the homesick thing comes into it as well. So you can't keep in touch with your mates. There's no mobile phones, texting everyone back then. Mm-hmm. Sounds like it's about 50 years ago, but, you know, you didn't have that. If you wanted to make a phone call, you went down to the phone box, threw a pound coin in, lasted for 30 seconds, and that was it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was that part. You probably didn't see, you know, or hear from your mates for about 3 or 4 months at a time, you know what I mean, before you went home. So it was tough. Big adjustments, you know.
When you did move over originally, as I said, we were living in Diggs, how well did the club look after you personally, from a personal point of view, regardless of obviously you had your training and what you were doing with the club, but did the club pay any attention to you as a person rather than as a player?
Well, in fairness, as a person they did, because they paid for digs obviously when you were, but I lived on Anfield Road, the big old houses that faced the Anfield Road, and that's where we lived. And to start off, there was two of us there, then the second year I think there was six of us, all Irish lads, you know. But like you're talking about, they were wary of the fact you're there and you're a young lad, so they would organise to come up and pick you up and bring you off to the cinema or that sort of stuff. But I mean, at the end of the day, you're still looking at 75-80% of your time sitting there on your own in the digs, you know what I mean? It's fairly lonely, especially at that age, you know.
Well, I was interested, the idea that nowadays with the academy structure that they put in place, they start to re-emphasise education and the whole lot that's involved with the kids. What level of emphasis was put on the education for you guys? Because you, as you said, you left the junior set, which is equivalent to the GCSEs in England, I'd say, right?
Yeah.
Was there much emphasis, like, because you're training with the club and the whole lot. What was the typical day like for you?
Well, typical day, probably grew up at 7:30, 8:30. I had to be over at the reception in Anfield. Got picked up by Sammy Lee every morning. Give him a hand, gone to the cobblers to fix the first team players' boots, which I'm sure wouldn't happen nowadays. Down to Melwood, you have your jobs. You're on a YTS scheme, youth training scheme at the time, so you basically were, you know, designated a job, whether it was boots, cleaning the medical room, whatever you had to do, set out the kit for the first team. That was your morning. First team rolled in at 10 o'clock. You were all back out of the dressing rooms, got yourself ready, and then trained till probably 12:30. Had your lunch, and that was it. At the first time I went over, double sessions never really happened, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time, you know, we kind of seen it as work to a certain extent, and we'd be kind of going home about 12:30, 1:00, and there's a couple of foreign Scandinavian lads there at the time, and they'd be going back out in the afternoon, you know, to practice their touch and this, that, and we'd be walking out kind of bleeding gobshites, you know. That kind of mentality, like, you know.
Yeah.
You look at these busy fuckers, you know.
Yeah.
We're all heading after the snooker hall or what have you. You know, it was crazy. I think in terms of the education, we done one half day a week on a Thursday, and we done a sports management course, which was completely useless at the time, you know. It was just a piss take. We went there in Anfield for about 2 or 3 hours on a Thursday, and you got some sort of piece of paper at the end to say you qualified, but it was crazy. Now, the last probably a year and a half when the academy was built, it all changed. It was a case of, you know, the full-time education people there and stuff like that, and I'm sure it's kicked on a million times more than when I was there, but even at that, it was still maybe a day a week max. You know, I kind of just left at the time when the education really, you know, started to come through and be more kind of, not full-time, but a lot of the time was taken up, right?
You know? So you were there 14 to 20 now, was it?
I left around when I was 19.
19?
Yeah.
So, in other words, the first 4 years or so were that routine that you described?
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
Right.
And then it was a kind of the changeover, more or less, came later with the academy being built down in Kirby.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, Melwood wasn't, I haven't been back to Melwood since I've left, but at the time, it wasn't very glamorous, you know? It was literally changing rooms, canteen, boot room, pitches, and that was it. The gym was dinosaur stuff, you know, because there wasn't a lot of emphasis on the gym work back then. Yeah. Like, you know, obviously, the foreign coaches came in, probably seen a change when Hulley came in at the time. When I went over first, Souness had just been sacked, Roy Evans had just got the job, then later on it was Roy Evans and Hulley, Roy Evans was gone, it was just Hulley, and the more the foreign players and the foreign manager came over, things started to change and the training and the things, and obviously the diet. Like, you go into the canteen when I first went over, you know, you're unheard of now, just like chicken burgers and chips and all sorts of stuff there for the first team players when they're having for their lunch, you know what I mean? It was crazy. But it was real, you know, seeing the pictures of Elwood nowadays, and it's this big state-of-the-art place, and I said at the time it was fairly basic. You went in, you done your jobs, and, you know, there was no two ways about it. Like, I remember I had a job cleaning the treatment room. I had the completely antibacterial stuff everywhere, and Mark Leto was the physio at the time. And if you didn't do that properly, I remember twice getting phone calls when I was back in the digs in Anfield Road saying, get your arse back down here. You didn't do it properly, and you'd have to get two buses back to Melwood and go back in with the mop and bucket and finish your job and back to the house. You know, like, that sort of stuff just wouldn't happen nowadays, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's all segregated, the first team training there, academy training there, you know, at the time it was...
Is there anything to be said for that, though, Niall? In comparison to the way people say that footballers are pampered now, you see the stories... They've all got little issues. They just seem to be a little bit above the law.
Well, look, I mean, I've spoke to kids that have gone away, and, you know, you give them a piece of advice where it was like when you went over and stuff. But as you say, the money end of things, kids going away now. You're talking million euro plus deals. So you're thinking people are going over. Is the hunger still there? You know what I mean? Yeah. But at the time, it was a case that you literally were a part of the team. You've done your work. You've got the boots ready for the players. And also, you have that closest with the players at the time, you know. So, I mean, in that way, you're kind of up front with the players, you're training with them. Every Friday, you'd have a game, U team against first team. The first team would play their team that they're going to play on the Saturday, go through their shape and stuff, tell us to play the way whoever they're going to play is going to play, you know?
Right.
That sort of stuff. So all that stuff was brilliant. But then when we moved up to the academy, that end was taken away from it. You know, you're literally just training with the kids.
So you with that group only?
Yeah, exactly.
So you settled in, you have your routine and the whole lot, right? What was it like in terms of the progression through? Like, how quickly did you feel that you were embedded in the actual team? And, you know, was there as much rotation of the kids through the teams as we see at the moment, where you'll see the 16s going play with the 21s?
Yeah.
You'll see the likes of Jerome Sinclair last year, West Brom making his debut for the full team. Now, maybe through necessity as opposed to choice, but you're starting to see those kids rotate through all the time. Yourself at the time, because it wasn't the same. Like the emphasis wasn't on squad as such back then. What was it like for you looking up? What was your aspiration in the first couple of years in terms of where you were?
It was funny when I first went over. I'd say I was 15, so obviously you had the A and B team. That's the way it used to be. There was no, you know, I was actually still eligible to play for the under 16s, which I did on occasions. But the full time lads, you basically play for the A or the B team, and then there was the reserves in the first team. So, starting off going over and looking at B team, A team, reserves and so on and so forth. But I remember I was only over there about 2 months, and maybe through lack of players, injuries, I don't know what happened, but I ended up playing in the reserves up front, Ray and Rush, 2 months after coming over, you know, it was crazy.
No.
I was only 15 at the time, you know, so we played Mountain Forest, and I remember at the time, Sammy Lee was the manager, Big Joe Corrigan was there, and talk about throwing in at the deep end, you know, you're playing tonight, I was going, play by who? The reserves of a match, we haven't got enough players who are in, so got there anyway, played up front with Rush. You know, that was bizarre, because you're talking 6 months before that, I was playing down in Sunderland Park, so, yeah. You know what I mean, with all lads my own age, so, in the space of 6 months, you're playing up front with someone like Rush, who's, you know, arguably one of the best players they've ever had over there, so, I mean, that kind of was a one-off. At that stage then, you're out with the B team, you know, some weeks, and when you're looking at the sheet, they put the sheet up on a Friday to say who the squads were, you know, you're looking to see in the A team, and that sort of stuff, and then when that kind of gradually phased out, they brought in the 17s and the 19s for the academy. So you'd start off, I was starting off in the 19s, I was a little bit older than the lads there, and then you'd go 19s reserves. So you're talking probably last year or so that I was there, I was a fairly regular in the reserves, you know. Mm. So I mean, at that stage, the reserves was, I mean, the loan culture wasn't there back then. A lot of the lads that were with us at the time probably would have, if it was nowadays, would have gone out on loan. You know, clubs would have come in saying, he's scoring goals in reserves, we'll take him, but back then it didn't happen. You know what I mean? Just didn't happen.
So what was the contact like between the reserve and first team squads? Obviously, it was the definition at the weekends when obviously yeah. reserves are playing whatever Saturday morning and first team are playing Saturday afternoon. But all week, without obviously knowing the squads, yeah. as you said, they were putting on Friday. So what was the interaction like when you were training with the reserves? Obviously, at that age, probably 70, whatever it might be, you probably weren't getting near the first team, but what yeah. was your role like within the group, basically?
Well, basically, if you trained with reserves, you were out with Sammy and Sammy Lee, and you had a mixture of kind of young pros like myself, with a couple of first team players probably on the way out, just being pushed into reserves to get them getting involved, keep them happy. You know, it was a strange atmosphere, because a lot of the first team players that come down didn't want to be there, didn't care, do you know what I mean? And then you'd have the young pros who were trying to make an impression and busting a gut and train and stuff like that. You'd have the senior pros looking at you, basically, you know, looking down on you, don't be bleeding, making a show on me, this kind of lark, you know. But I mean, at the time, basically you spent your week with the reserves and then you played your game at the weekend, but it was literally a case of first team players were taken off, reserves were sent off, and you know, you kind of had a fair idea who you're going to be teamed up with come the weekend, you know. But I mean, the reserve games back then, very rarely would you play in Anfield. Like, a lot of the games you'd play in Gig Lane or places like that, small grounds, you know, where you'd get a decent crowd at them as yeah. well. So it was kind of, at the time, I mean, the reserves are a tough league, especially when you're a young lad, you know, it's really tough.
So you're in the pile, you're in the fish pond at the time, when you're over. Obviously back home, you're big. Your mates to the area, the whole lot. You are a big name. You're in the reserves for Liverpool and the whole lot. What was it like to come back and say play with the 19th and stuff for Ireland?
Well, when I went over four, you're coming back playing with the 16s, yeah. Ireland, you know, 16s, 17s, and up to 18s, 19s, 20s, all that sort of stuff. But originally, you're coming back playing the 16s, and you know, you're mixing with other lads that have gone off to other clubs, like I said, the likes of Robbie Keane and Richie Dunne and stuff, where Steve McPhail were all around their age group. So it was great to see them, because you knew them from school way growing up. But I mean, you're talking about back in the area, it was probably, a lot of players have gone away from Tala since then, but it was probably the first kind of big marquee sign, if you like, that went to a big club, and there was a lot of attention focused around at the time, you know. Yeah. I mean, if people often said to me, would you not think you should have better off gone to a smaller club, start those small, build your way up, you know, which is easy to say, there's cases to be made for both ways you go, you know what I mean, but at the time, it's very hard to turn down a club like Liverpool that come in for you, you know. And my parents at the time, they hadn't got a clue about football. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So they're not going to be there to advise me as such. Do you know what I mean? So, and you go home at the weekends, maybe every 3 or 4 months, see your mates as much as you can, and you try and be normal, but you know yourself, there's a lot of people want to come up and knock at your door and say, can you get us a ticket? Can you get us a jersey? Can you get us this? Can you get us that? You know? But it was brilliant. I used to go back to the schools when I come home as well, see the teachers, that sort of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it was a big deal in the area at the time, because you're talking about a place that was, you know, fairly poor at the time, yeah. you know yourself, so it was a massive deal.
And then when you went, obviously, as you said, you're coming back and forth and you're playing with the Irish schoolboy teams. When you went back over, how close did you think you were getting towards getting into the first team?
Well, it's probably a case that every time you got a few goals to reserve, you looked up and there's another multi-million pound player coming through the door, you know, so
sorry for putting you on, what I'm yeah. trying to say is, were you thinking, well, you're scoring a few goals and you're thinking, I need to be getting closer and closer to the first team.
Yeah.
And how many promises were there any promises made that you might get in, you might get on the bench?
Well, to be honest with you, if you're talking about at the time, I was a centre forward, you had Robbie Fowler, you had Caroline Driever, you had Rush, who was probably coming towards the end at the time, you had Michael Owen, who was breaking through, you had Collymore, do you know what I mean? So I mean, I was always looking at it wary of the fact that, you know, I've got to do something ridiculous here to kind of push past all them people to get. So I've never really, I know it might sound strange, but I never really sat there thinking, you know, I'm going to make the big breakthrough here, I'm going to be a superstar at Liverpool. I was kind of always mindful of the thought that
it might not work out.
It just might work out, but you still love the fact that you're there and playing, and, you know, whether it's the reserves or the 19s or whatever you are, you love playing. But at the time, there's so many players ahead of you, and so many players, like Fowler at the time, was on fire. You know, Michael Owen burst under the scenes on fire. So,
were you looking at, as you said, you were playing Robbie Keane with the youth international, were you looking at Robbie Keane playing with Wolves and then going to Coventry at that age for a massive amount of money? And were you looking at him going, geez, that could be me? Was that a thought in your mind?
It's kind of like Robbie went away the same age as I did, but obviously I'm playing for the 19s, he's making his debut on the senior team, you know. So, but look, that's the argument that people have till the cows come home, you know what I mean? That if you go up, Joe Wolves is a lot of people say if you start off at Wolves and it doesn't work out, where do you go from there? Do you know what I mean? A lot of people that go away to Liverpool, Manchester, and it doesn't work out, they'll always be picked up generally by other clubs. Do you know what I mean? So, but in fairness to him, he hit the ground running and took a chance. So, I mean, you can't knock the fella.
No, no. And now, who impressed you when you were there in terms of staff and in terms of the players? If you had to pick maybe one of each or two?
Staff wise, I mean, it's very difficult. Like, you're talking the likes of Steve Highway, Sammy Lee, at the you know, who are Liverpool legends, but at the time I wasn't. Didn't really know a lot about the history of the club, do you know what I mean? So we really did, it was just Steve and Sammy.
They're just someone that's telling you what to do.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So you don't really look at them as these kind of iconic people that, like, I remember at the time I was really good friends with Alan Kennedy. I hadn't a clue who he was. Right. Just some bloke that used to come around the club. Right. You know what I mean? It was only years later that you kind of found out that this fella's legend, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's our, of the staff, I was very close to Sammy Lee.
Right.
Very close to Sammy, so. He was probably the one that stood out at the staff, you know.
Right. In terms
players
of
wise, again, there were so many top players at the time, you know, really conducted themselves and looked after the young lads. And I mean, in terms of a player, me being a centre forward, the one that stood out for me was probably Fowler.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Genuinely nice fella. Always had time for the kids, and you know, just we used to do shooting practice with him. It was ridiculous. You know, ridiculous.
Yeah.
Left foot, right foot headers. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
The fella had it all, you know.
Yeah.
So he was probably the one that impressed me the most.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Any other questions then from the lads?
Yeah. How fat did Ruddock get in the pre-season, before the season started? Like, seriously. You're there. I've seen the pictures of you training with them.
Yeah.
And he was wearing a pair of cycling shorts that looked like, I don't know how to describe them, because they looked like a skirt wrapped around each leg. That's probably the best one.
Well, it's funny because I'm actually still a very good mate with Razor. So he'd be one of the few ones that I keep in touch with. Don't ask why, but anyway. At the time, I actually only had this conversation with someone the other day. At the time, when you went home for your pre-season break, you know, you got 8 weeks off. You came back, you start back training. And you're talking 14 players, not just Razor, coming back a stone overweight. Do you know what I mean? And literally, the coaches at the time handed them a black bag and saying, train with that for the next 4 weeks, over you. You know, it was crazy stuff. It's not like, at the time, your fitness levels probably, you know, went from 100% down to 30%.
Yeah.
And then you had to struggle for 8 weeks to get them back up again, where nowadays they probably dip 15-20%, and you know, obviously you have your time off and porn, but the pros nowadays, they just don't stop for the summer. They're given programs to maintain their fitness levels and stuff, but back then it was crazy. You had all sorts of players coming back, major league overweight.
So you say 19, did you know it was coming to the end?
Well, it's kind of been on, when I was 19, I was actually on my third contract, believe it or not.
Mm.
So I'd been given another contract for a year, which suited me because I wanted to see how the last year went. Julio was after being appointed at the start of that year, which I thought was a strange situation because Roy Evans was there. I actually thought he'd done a decent job at the time. A lot of people said he was too nice for the job, but they brought Julio in as joint manager, which I thought was ridiculous. He should have just sacked the man and gave Julio the job in the first place. But when Julio got the job on his own, he didn't really take much of an interest in the reserves or the youths and that sort of stuff. Which in fairness to Roy Evans at the time he did. But I remember in particular my contract came up for renewal and I sat down with Steve Hoyle and we both agreed, look, you're probably banging your head against the wall here in terms of getting into the first team. So it's probably you're better off going elsewhere and getting first team football. So
that kind of suited me at the time. But then I played, I'd say it was about 3 months before the end of the season, we played everything in the mini derby, and I think it was in Gig Lane. It was a major, about 5,000 or 6,000 people there. It was the fourth reserve game that Hooley had come to watch since he'd been taken over, and he had Phil Thompson there as his assistant manager. And I remember the game, I scored the winner, we beat them 1-0, had a good game, Richie Dunn was playing at the time. And after the match, Hooley pulled me and said, look, what's the situation with your contract? And I said, my contract's up in a few weeks, you know, I've already decided I'm going on. And he was like, no, don't go anywhere, we want to sign you again, and we'll get you out on loan next season, and this sort of stuff. And that kind of threw a spanner in the works, you know. I was kind of, well, I kind of made my mind up, I'm going to push on. And I say that at the time, it was hard to turn down to stay as well. So at the time, I was kind of torn between the both. And to be honest with you, that was around the time, I think Wigan came in for me, offered me a 2-year deal. I had mad offers to go to China and stuff like that, you know. But I came home that summer to think about, which would have been 1999. I came home to have a little think about what I was going to do, and never went back. You know,
never went back. Do you think that was down to the fact that the club weren't like, was Hooley being honest with you? Do you think he was being honest with you?
I think he was. I think he was kind of surprised at how well a lot of young lads at the time were playing, you know, because the first team squad weren't set in the world away. And he decided to go down and have a look what was below that pile, and he probably got surprised, you know, the talent that was there. But I was kind of made my mind about that stage of going. That kind of threw a spanner in the works. So I remember at the time I was at the going down the agent route, and I had an agent who was, you know, washing me clothes now for me at the time. So he kind of, I said, look, I'll take a couple of weeks off, I'll go home, I'll think about what I'm going to do, and I'll get back in touch with you. He said, okay, well, look, Liverpool are back the 7th of July and Wigan are back the 6th of July, wherever it was at the time. So he said, right, well, give me a shout in a couple of weeks, I'll let you know. And then he'd ring me and say, look, they're on looking to find out what you're doing. I said, look, give me a ring next week, I haven't decided yet, you know. And before you know it, the time had passed, I was back home, I was living with a board, I was enjoying the high life, and that was it then, the phone call stopped, you know.
Can you talk us through that year of immediately post Liverpool, and the decision making process and motivation and all that type of thing that takes you from being part of a huge club to deciding to opt out voluntarily?
Yeah, it was crazy, you know. At the time I probably didn't have a lot of guidance. I'm not saying that that's anyone else's fault but my own fault. What I say to people, I can handle the fact that I mess things up myself. Do you know what I mean? A lot of people like to blame, well, that manager didn't like me, or this fella done this to me, this fella done that. Like, I basically made a balls of myself, and I put my hand up to that. And it's easier to accept, funny enough, you know. But at the time when I came back, it was just like, I remember I hit a period around coming towards Christmas where I hadn't got a club. And, you know, all the lads were back training and stuff. And I remember going, what the name is Jays I'm at the doing, you know. So I hadn't got a club. I remember at the time I got a phone call off Pat Dolan, who was managing Pat's at the time with Liam Buckley. Asked would I go down. So I said, look, I'm not doing anything else, so I'll wander down and play a few games and see what happens. And I mean, my condition fitness wise had just deteriorated. I had no interest, you know, I literally had lost all interest. Don't ask me why. I just, you know, I went from training every day, having this structured lifestyle, you have to be here, you have to do this, you have to do this, and to basically coming back to doing nothing. You know what I mean? Back in, and the funny thing is, when you come home, you know, all your mates are in work, so you're sitting around all day going, nothing that I'm Jason doing here. So I ended up going down to Pat's, didn't last very long, I left in the end, and that's when Stephen Kenny actually came in and took me to Longford at the time, you know. Which was a bit of a culture shock, because at the time Longford weren't a very big club, you know, they were kind of only at the coming into the Premier Division. And I mean, you're going from a case of, you know, the glitzy lights of a big club like Liverpool and going to Anfield and stuff, then down to Strokestown Road, and you know, we trained over at the back of the driving range on Selbridge, and you probably had to kick 1,000 balls off the training ground before you could start training and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But in fairness, I bought into it, and I think I was there for about 2 or 3 months, done a really hard pre-season, got myself back into condition. We went down to Limerick, we're doing 4 sessions a day, it was mad stuff. Got myself back, and in the back of my mind, I'd be in touch with a couple of clubs in England, prove your fitness, get yourself back scoring a few goals, and you'd be back on the plane again. And we were playing a pre-season friendly against Northampton Town. And remember the first half, I was doing really well, I was actually happy with myself. Second half, went up for a header, landed awkward, and my leg just snapped under me. That was that.
What was the injury then?
Broken ankle.
Right.
Broken ankle, dislocated ankle. So had the operation, screws, bolts, was out for about, it's been for the bones of a year, you know. Came back then, and I think Longford were kind of middle of the season, so I missed all of the pre-season the following year and stuff like that. So I was playing catch-up fitness-wise, had to go and have another operation, came back, was playing in the first team at the time when I was nowhere near fit enough to be playing. I played down in Cork the year we got to the cup final for the first time, the FAI cup final, and scored the winner down in Cork. Was playing okay, but I knew in the back of my mind I wasn't doing myself justice, I just wasn't fit. And I come to the time, I think we were in the semi-final of the FAI cup, I just walked away.
What age were you?
I was like 20. 20, yeah. Maybe pushing 21 at the time. Walked away, and then a couple of months later I ended up back playing Mickey Mouse football with my mate's team, AOL Premier B.
It's a fairly dramatic
from Grace.
Clash,
right? We may have to, well, at the time it was like, you know, get yourself, do a few training sessions. You know, I wasn't interested, so I do a few training sessions, get yourself fit. A couple of League of Ireland clubs were still knocking on the door, you know, trying to get me back. I was still young enough to get myself fit and have a decent career in League of Ireland, you know. At the time, the money was starting to get really big in the league, so I went training with this local team, and 2 weeks after I started trying to get myself back into shape, I broke my other leg.
Dear God.
And I've done, since then, I've done both my legs twice on my collarbone by the time I was 24. Someone was telling me something, it's time to pack it in.
Yeah, there's a message coming there.
Yeah, so that's what I did. I think it was 23, maybe 24 at the time. I just decided that's it. That's not it. Doing it anymore, yeah.
I know you were saying no one really was there to advise you back when you went over. Would you have any advice for kids that maybe are having the opportunities to go over now? Like, I know it's a lot different, there's more kids going over. But do you think like it's an idea to stay for a few years and say, prove yourself here first?
In an ideal world, you know, it's been proven that kids that go away later probably have a better chance. They're more mature, you get your education. As I say, I came home from England, junior cert under my belt, nothing else. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not a penny in the pocket. So kids going over now, it's a different kettle of fish. Ideal situation, they'd all stay and, you know, train together and stuff like that. But where do you get the games that are going to improve them as players and stuff, you know? So what I always say to kids going away, I remember in particular one case, a good friend of mine, John Paul Kelly, was going to Liverpool. And at the time, Lewis asked me to just have a chat with him and tell him, you know, this sort of stuff. So I remember I pulled Jockshire and I spoke to him about it since, and I said, look, this 4 or 6 months is probably the hardest. If you can last 6 months over it, you probably last 6 years, because it gets easier after that. 4 or 6 months, very tough. And I think he was home in 5 months. You know what I mean? Right. So it's a big culture shock, and some kids can't handle it, you know. Yeah. But a lot of the stuff now with kids gone away, it's gone crazy. They're moving the families over to keep the kids happy and stuff, which is not a bad thing, you know. You wouldn't uproot all my lot, there was 6 of us. But a lot of the parents are going over with the kids now, which is not a bad thing either, you know. But I mean, it's the easy argument to say people should stay later, but it's very hard to turn it down when it knocks on your door as well, you know.
Well, just last question for you. Well, not last question, but you're back involved again and again.
Back involved again, yeah.
Back, well, you're managing now.
Yeah, I mean,
passing on the advice.
Trying to.
Are you back in love with the game, more to the point?
Yeah, to be honest with you, when I was out of the game around the 23-24 mark, I got a phone call from Leo. It's funny how things work in circles, and it was my old manager, Barry Bradley, who rang me and said, will you come down and do a bit of coaching with the kids? So I went down and took over a team. I think we were under 12 at the time, and I took over a 12 Premier team, and I had them for 3 years. And it was more or less when I went back over with the kids, that's when I actually fell back in love with the game. You know, it was crazy. I was just like, this is what I want, you know. And I was coaching and enjoying it. I had the kids for 3 years, and a couple of them went on to England and that sort of stuff. And you know, it was great to be able to pass on that kind of advice, which was fairly fresh at the time, you know. But then of course the money end of things came into it, and I got offered a couple of senior managers job, which I took my fourth senior managers job when I was about 25, and I've been doing it ever since, really, you know. But I've been on and off working with the kids as well, but you know, I've more or less run the senior teams nearly the last 10 years, so.
Good.
So it's kind of a case. I still enjoy it. It's different now. You have to work, you have a job, and you know what I mean? You go training and you have kids and wives and mortgages and stuff like that. You know, back then it was all you had to worry about was football.
Yeah.
And you still made an arse of it, you know what I mean?
Well, I think we've been torturing you long enough now. Thanks a million for
no
that. We'll get you involved in our quick